Stay hungry, stay foolish.
It's a great honor to welcome Carlo Pignataro, author of Sell With Style, to the show. Welcome to the show, Carlo.
Thank you very much, Aidan. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
Yeah, and thanks for joining us all the way from Italy. You have a huge background in the luxury industry, and we're in a world now where the consumer wants everything free, perfect, and now. And that's really changed the dynamic of how a brand can operate in the world. And the luxury industry has been working this way for a very, very long time. And there's a killer line in your book, "Attention to detail is a long-term strategy." And I just thought that was such a profound line, in that you have to think about every aspect of your brand, every touch point, whether it's digital or physical, and every little attention to detail needs to be catered for, because people have so much choice now that you have to cater for every aspect.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. The Innovation Show is just brilliant, so I'm honored to be here with you today, Aidan. That line, which I didn't put much of an emphasis in the book, I think is what I stand for ultimately. You see, I spent most of my adult life working as a manager and as a salesperson as well in the luxury goods industry internationally. I've worked with brands like Gucci. I've been a consultant for companies like Armani, World Gold Council, DTC, and so forth. And my understanding, if you will, of what has made certain prestigious, incredible, seducing brands, what has made them successful over time. Because when you think of brands like Hermès, for example, or Gucci, or Ferrari, or Cartier, you're talking about brands that have been successful, emotionally linked to their audience for 50, 60, 100, 200 years. And what I learned from this brand is consistency. And consistency is something that you build only by developing an eye for details, by making the details that differentiate you, that make you unique in the eyes of your audience, by focusing on those details. And that's where I come up with the idea that not only luxury is a personalization of emotions, but is actually the ability to focus on details constantly, continuously, on a daily basis, consistently, until those details have made up your identity.
Yeah, so the dots eventually connect, but it's all based on this eye for detail, or this attention to detail.
Indeed.
I see this as so relevant for, we have a lot of startups and CEOs who listen to this show, and in a way it's very, very relevant for them, because they have to enter into a world that is just full of competition. And it's not only the aspect of eye for detail, it's the behind the scenes work that you really delve into in the book about selling, because selling is always seen as this kind of dirty thing or lower end thing. And you've positioned it so well in the book, but you've put a framework behind sales and a framework behind the attention to detail from a sales perspective. So it's not just about the brand or the product, it's about how you represent that down to the salesman. Can we talk about that and talk about stuff like, for example, the meta communication, and get into that for a little bit?
With pleasure. You see, Aidan, you may call me a romantic person, but I do think that selling is the highest form of service. Look, you mentioned something before that is pretty much interesting for me. When you said people are expecting everything for free today, that's absolutely right if you look at certain economies. But at the same time, we never had so many people with an access to wealth. We never had in history that many people having their basic needs being met and willing to spend money to invest in their well-being. Ultimately, what do people having their basic needs being met want? They want to feel good about what they do. They want to feel good about themselves. So yes, most people want something for free, but also there's a lot of people willing to pay for having the opportunity to express themselves, to feel good about themselves, to emotionally feel that their life is worthwhile. And that's what we in the luxury industry, but when I talk about the luxury industry, I'm not referring to jewelry and fashion or high-end cars only. I'm referring to whatever company in whatever industry is positioning itself in the high segment, in the high end of the market. Our goal is to make people feel good about what they are doing with us, feel good about the business they are doing with us. And to do that, the figure of a salesperson is vital, is crucial, is the deal maker, is the person that ultimately give you access to what you, client or consumer, want. And that's why I'm in love with it. I have started my own sales training business, not because I had to, but just because I loved it. And I thought when I started that by improving, by enhancing, and by empowering the people performing client service, client experience, the customer service, and by giving them some practical tools and some intellectual challenges that would make them think and rethink their position amongst their company, this wouldn't be my little contribution to the world. And I must tell you that it's happening. I see people rethinking the way they deal with clients. I see people giving their clients the attention and the details we were talking about before that the clients needs, and calling me at the end of the day saying, Carlo, it's working. I see happier people getting out of my office, getting out of my shop, getting out of my whatever they meet them, and I'm happier myself. And that's great. I just love it.
And it's so important. It's been so overlooked. The world doesn't tolerate it anymore. Carla, one of the interesting things I really got into comes from the world of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and you talk about that in depth in the book. Could we touch on that for the moment for about meta-signals? Because there's a great analogy you give about meta one, which is moving towards and moving away from. Could we touch on that for a moment?
I think this is very funny because you see something that most companies forget about is to give a personalized service to their clients. And moving away from or moving towards something is a very good example of this. And during my training sessions, I often bring up this example. So I want to share this example with you, if you don't mind. Think of a client entering a high-end jewelry store. And this client is a busy businessman who wants to buy a jewel for his wife's birthday. Okay. Now, this person happens to be very busy, happens to have a wife who's chasing him about the gift, a very demanding wife. And yes, he's happy about celebrating his wife's birthday. However, this is not his first priority. So what he does, he asks his secretary to do a little bit of research, gets into the store and wants to buy that item as quick as possible and get out and go back to his office. So he goes into the store and he starts having a conversation about the sales associate. And the sales associate starts showing him around, telling him about the greatness of the brand and how many beautiful choices there are and how happy his wife is going to be. But unfortunately, the client is not going towards something, which would be the celebration of his wife's birthday, but instead is moving away the hustle of having to buy a present for her birthday. So he doesn't want that kind of interaction. He just wants to make sure that he's buying the right product at the right price, and he can do it as quickly as possible. So a sales associate who would spend too much time, would stress too much on the product's features and the beauty and the uniqueness of the product would fail. But same situation could happen with a husband who's totally and incredibly in love with his wife, and he has been waiting for her birthday for a year, and he can't wait to celebrate and give her this beautiful gift and everything that happens after. So he goes into the store and he wants to make a selection. He wants to dream about it. He's moving towards something. So here, the customer service associate, the salesperson attitude and approach should be completely different. What do you want to do in this case? You want the client to dream with you, to leave the celebration in advance. So same situation, one gift, one jewel for one wife. Changes drastically in terms of sales approach when you understand if the client is moving away from something, such as the hassle of having to buy a gift, or is moving towards something, which happens to be wanting to celebrate with your wife such an important occasion. I also have to add, Aidan, that NLP is one of the ingredients that I bring into my luxury sales education, because along with NLP, I do bring a lot of philosophy as well, a lot of art history, a lot of music, because luxury really is a human attempt to reach divinity through beauty. So when people start thinking about it, they make an intellectual exercise that boils down into some beautiful practical choices for their people to deliver a fantastic client experience.
And that's the piece, Carlo. That really comes across in the book. And sales, from a perspective of the past, I feel, was very much just get out there and sell no matter what. It doesn't matter if it's a good sale or a bad sale. But what comes very much across in the book is the luxury industry is a pure one in that it is about beauty, it's about art, and that it needs to be matched in how it's represented by the salesperson. And the salesperson needs to actually be that type of person as well. So your selection of salesperson needs to be very, very astute as well. And you need to pick the right people to represent you in that way.
I agree. You need to pick impeccable people.
This is a framework. You give some great examples. And when you kind of think about that in your own world, you kind of see different type of people coming into your office that are in different ways, or different people that you're meeting for coffee, etc. And you kind of start to see them in the framework that you've given. And one of the ones I loved was the internal frame of reference versus an external frame of reference person. Can we touch on that one as well for a moment?
Sure. Internal frame of reference is a focus. There are people who are used to look inside when it comes to take decisions, make decisions. CEOs, entrepreneurs, self-made men and women are often basing their decisions upon their own judgment. They usually have a very strong personality. They don't wonder what other people would do. They just follow their gut and they follow their instinct. Whereas some other people need to see proofs that something has been working for somebody else before. And those are the people who need to see the celebrities endorsing a brand. Those are people who need to see that other competitors have bought the same product or the same service or have gone the same way. And they are completely different when it comes to selling to those clients. A person with an internal frame of reference needs to be approached in a very unique and personalized way. You ask them questions such as, how do you like it? How would you like to go ahead with it? How would you like to start this business relationship? Whereas when you are talking to a person with a very external frame of reference, a person who needs to see that such solution, such product, such service has been bought, used, and tested before, you show them proofs. You tell them how happy your old clients are. You show them your book full of celebrities endorsing your brands or wearing your brands or using your products and so forth. Salespeople tend to be a little bit too stiff when it comes to identifying what kind of clients they have in front of them. They kind of stick to what they have learned, what they have developed in terms of brand's presentation or company's presentation or product's presentation with time, and they forget to differentiate between the approach that is being needed in a certain situation. It's funny because when I started with the idea of writing my book, I had my personal interpretation of what luxury was about, which was pretty much standard, if you will, although I had spent many years in the luxury industry already. But then I took a step and I decided that I wanted to interview some industry leaders in order to get their opinion. And talking to people like Mr. Gianni Bulgari, the former president and CEO of the Bulgari Jewelry House, talking to Mr. Giacomo Santucci, who's the former CEO of Gucci, and two people who have given me the gift of writing beautiful forewords for my book, I realized that ultimately clients expect uniqueness. Whether this uniqueness comes from you giving them a personalized product, you giving them a personalized experience, you giving them personalized conditions, but luxury happens to be the celebration of uniqueness. It's something that I'm driven by every day when I wake up in the morning. I always tell myself, Carlo, today you have to find the opportunity. You have to work to create the opportunity to make somebody feel unique and special. Because if you can achieve that, you are on the right track.
It's not just about personalization. It actually ultimately about a segment of one. So you're trying to reach one person in a unique way. And that's why this framework is so important. And When you apply it all and you pay real attention to the details here, like your CRM, for example, so your management system of your contacts becomes very, very deep. While in so many companies, it's a struggle to get somebody to put in an email address and spell the name correctly. If you read your book, you go and revisit your CRM and you start going, is this person internally motivated or externally motivated? Are they a matcher or a mismatcher? We might touch on that in a second as well, Carlo. But you start to put in the meta signals of those type of people and almost segment them into those categories. You know, what type of theater do they like, or do they like to go to sports games? But it goes much deeper than that, and it goes into what type of questions work with that type of person, or what type of influence works with them, etc. I love the matchers. It comes from NLP as well, Carla. Can we touch on that one as well? Because I think our audience would really like that.
Yes. This is, again, a very funny differentiator, if you will, but let me add something to start with. I think that everything boils down to the willingness and then the ability to listen and listen carefully. Ultimately, whatever we give people, they want to feel that they made the right choice. And more often than not, before people can validate their choice, they need to have spoken about their needs. And that's what most companies and then most loyalty programs, and it boils down to salespeople approach, don't give a client a chance to. Companies, brands, CRMs, loyalty programs, salespeople, customer service associates, don't give their clients a real opportunity to speak out, to express their needs. And that's what we need to do. Give somebody the opportunity to express himself, to express herself. This is a client. This person will become a client, will turn into a client sooner or later. So when we build our business strategies upon this very simple yet very fine element, everything just makes sense. Everything just simply follows because the direction is very clear. The direction is, I want to listen to my clients. Millennials today don't buy anymore unless they feel they are part of the process. So how are you going to sell something to a millennial today unless you make this person feel part of the process? You don't give them ready-made products anymore. You give them the opportunity to choose. You present your products in advance. You ask them to choose between a cover of a book and another cover for the same book, so because they want to contribute. So this gives us the opportunity to look into meta programs, what you were referring to, which NLP has extensively touched. Tony Robbins has extensively explained in his beautiful work. And I have picked six or seven, which in my opinion are very interesting in terms of sales process, one of which happens to be matchers or mismatchers. And again, it's something very simple, something that most of us have experienced before, yet we tend to forget about it or not focus about it enough. Matchers are people, and they are the majority, by the way, are people who kind of looking for similarities. Those are the people who try to find something in common with the people they meet. So they get into your store, they enter your office, they meet you for coffee, and naturally, they try to find something in common with you in order to link to you, in order to develop a relationship. It's part of the personality. It's who they are. So unless you do something wrong, you can start talking about the weather or family or sports, whatever. You find something in common, you go for it, and you build a relationship. Very simple, very clear, something that salespeople have been trained for all their life, and most of which are good at. But there's another category of people, and they are the mismatchers. Mismatchers are people who need to say no before they can say yes. It's a personality trait. It's a mind frame. It's something they do unconsciously. It's something they have become, or they have been before, or they were born with, without knowing it. They need to say no before they say yes. Doctors, quality insurance managers in factories tend to develop a mismatching approach because they need to look at something and they have to spot the flaws. They have to spot the small details that are outplaced. So these people kind of develop this mental frame with time. With mismatchers, mismatchers are people entering in a room and they will notice what is different from the other room rather than noticing what's similar to the other room. Those are people I mentioned, I showed in the book a picture of three eggs. The three eggs were absolutely identical with the exception of the shade of the color. One was a little bit darker. So matchers would see three eggs, whereas mismatchers would see two lighter colors, color eggs and one darker color eggs, egg. And that's what you need to keep in mind when you meet a mismatcher. A mismatcher is a person that will start every sentence with, no, I don't agree, I don't think so. So let's say you are in the retail business and you are approaching a mismatcher. Instead of saying something like, I would like to show you something, this new arrival, this beautiful new collection, you will say instead, listen, I have a new collection, but I don't think you would be interested in. The mismatcher will tell you, no, I want to see it.
I can try it in my personal life as well, maybe. Such a valuable framework, Carlo, and it's an absolute must-buy. Really, what I take from what you've said is this is about listening with more than your ears. It's listening with every sense and capturing that sense and then bringing that back and capturing it in your CRM and remembering that and developing a deep relationship with your client and your customer and your people, essentially.
Yes, and it's also about giving them the impression that you are listening, because that's what they ultimately need. You see, some people won't need you to go too far in terms of personalization. Except you have given them the opportunity to speak out their mind. When you physically engage in the while listening with your clients, physically or with other tools, engage, and you make them feel heard, that's all they need. I'm not trying to underestimate the importance of product. I'm not trying to underestimate the importance of after sales. But what I'm trying to say is, since society is moving towards a speak and talk attitude, look at social media today, look at the Big Brother, everyone wants to be listened to, everyone wants to be heard, everyone feels that their Daily small things are relevant and important for the rest of the world. That the moment, the minute you give them enough attention, you have won them commercially and emotionally. What do you do with it really depends on your work ethic. My two cents, your work ethic should be impeccable.
Yeah, and that comes across in the book. There are things you take for granted, that the salesperson is impeccably dressed, their speech is impeccable. When you read this book, you go, okay, well, those things are done. This brings it to a whole new level. That's certainly the feel I got from reading the book.
I think it's just so important. I think it's a matter of respect. The minute you look at yourself in the mirror and you make sure that you are impeccable, the minute you listen to the conversations you made, I don't mean you have to record yourself when you're having a conversation with your clients, but try to think about it when you go to sleep at night. But being impeccable is just a matter of respect. It's a matter of respect for yourself to start with. And it's a matter of respect for your clients. Nobody likes lazy people. You want to show your clients that you are in control, you are engaged, you are committed. And how can you possibly do that if you forget to clean up your shoes in the morning? Just to give you a small example. How can you do that if you forget to... I don't know, look after the small details that make you look impeccable. I just think it doesn't make sense. It's a matter of coherence as well. You have to be coherent with your message. I travel the world and I work with some of the most prestigious brands in the world, and I train their sales team, their customer service associates. I do design the client experience for companies. And to me, it all boils down in people and stakeholders buying the concept that what you do is a matter of respect. Respect for yourself, respect for your clients. You want to be impeccable because you know that your life is going to be better, because you know that your credibility is based upon your consistency. It's not an obligation, it's a choice.
Carlo, I really appreciate you coming on the show. The book is Sell With Style. I'll have links on the website and on social media for people to buy it. It's a must buy. It's on Kindle, so easily accessible on Amazon. Carlo Pignatoro, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Aidan.
Okay, we're rolling. So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Buddy Reiser, Executive Director of Loudoun County Data Center Cluster. Welcome to the show, Buddy.
Aidan, thank you for having me. This is exciting for me.
It's great to have you here in Ireland, and we're in the cellar of the Merion Hotel, sipping on fine coffee. 10 a.m. talking data, man.
That's right.
Living the dream.
Living the dream. No, this is such an exciting time for anybody that's involved with data. The explosion of this industry has just been tremendous. We're very excited to be partnering with the Dublin cluster and talking about how we can grow together.
Yeah. So before we talk about data center clusters, because a lot of the listeners may not know what that is, let's talk about you, because you, I feel like the master and the apprentice, except I'm the apprentice here, because you've owned your own radio stations. You've been a shock jock on those stations. And how did you get to being executive director of a data center cluster?
Well, you know, I grew up with really two loves. I grew up loving business. Like, I created my first business when I was 10 years old. And I grew up with a love of radio. So when I started down the radio path, I really thought this is something that I would do as a hobby until I got a real job. You know how that is. So along the lines, my radio career kept going and going and going. When I went to university, I went for business. I didn't even go for radio. Spent a lot of time at the major markets in Washington, D.C. on the number one rock station, and eventually decided to try to blend my two loves together and bought my own radio station. I ran that for a few years. After I sold that, I decided I needed to reinvent and decided that I wanted to use all of my experience with business to kind of help other businesses grow. And that's how I ended up in economic development.
Yeah, and it's interesting because with data, you would have seen the value of that from a radio station, because there's so much of it is, you know, done by survey and phone calls and, you know, tracking people that way rather than the hardcore kind of tracking that should be done to actually give real statistics.
Yeah. And we were amongst the first that really started focusing on using data to determine how to program our radio station, research on the songs, research on the listeners, and trying to really do a data-driven approach to how we were running our radio station, and it worked out very, very well. So that was really something that kind of opened my eyes to the possibilities. And so that was an important part of my transition.
So when you sold the station, then you decided to focus on this and data center clusters. Let's talk about them, because what is a data center cluster? Because so many people will only know the output of that, not mm-hmm. knowing what that is.
Well, you know, it's such a data-driven society now, and everything that we do is captured somewhere. The way we consume information has changed. We've all become content creators. Every time that we put something on social media, on the Facebook or anything, you know, that information is stored somewhere. When we watch a soccer match on our phones, or we're reading a book online, or all that information has to be stored and processed and distributed somewhere. And by and large, that is done in data centers. And as the data centers begin to grow, you need a few things. You need the fiber, you need the power, you need the technical expertise, some sort of proficiency in being able to put the things together. And that was really what we focused on 10 years ago. We decided, you know, we had AOL in our community and Verizon Business, and decided, you know, this is a place we want to go. So we started really focusing on creating the environment where data centers could grow and thrive. And it has really paid off well. We're currently the largest data center cluster in the entire world.
Wow. So, and that's the really interesting part, because you've built an ecosystem around it. It's not simply get a warehouse, you know, make sure the temperature is right, mm-hmm. and you know, fill it with data and let open the taps, essentially. It's a building that ecosystem around it. And you've done that from a very early stage, because data's become sexy in the last 2 to 3 years, perhaps, right, where everybody's talking about it, and data-driven companies and data-driven everything. And mainly because they meant the content of the world. But you were very, very early mover mm-hmm. to spot the opportunity to build the ecosystem. And that's really part of the whole success.
It really is. And that's really what the driver is. I mean, the data centers themselves, they bring great tax revenue to the jurisdictions. It's a high investment number. We're talking about millions and millions of dollars. But when you're building a community, what you want to do is create everything around it. You want to drive business, you want to drive jobs, you want to drive, you know, the secondary and tertiary markets, right? So originally, you know, you start building what that infrastructure looks like, and that was the data centers. Then there's that entire economy that comes around that, the people that build it. You know, there hasn't been one day without data center construction in our county in 10 years. So you start to think about all of the people that are involved in building it, then operating it, then servicing it. And then it's all the customers that are inside it. We have 3,000 technology companies in our 100 or so data centers. So you start to think about how does that all start to work together. And where we ended up is data centers contribute over $150 million a year to our local economy. And it's taken a few years, but now the job numbers are coming along as well. We were number 3 in the entire United States of America in job growth last year. And a lot of that is attributed to our data center cluster.
So if you're looking at the ingredients of what you've done, the ingredients of success, what do you put in the mixing bowl to mm-hmm. make this happen? Like if you're looking at, say, for example, here, somebody has the foresight mm-hmm. to look at this as a new revenue stream or a new growth pattern, or from mm-hmm. the government perspective, it's like, this is a huge opportunity.
Right.
What kind of things do you need to put in that mixing bowl?
Well, I think it's a lot of things. And, you know, Gary Connolly, who's kind of running the cluster here in Dublin, talks about the 5 P's. And we kind of talk about the same thing. It's making sure that you have the fiber, the internet infrastructure that you need. Then it's making sure you have the power, the workforce. You need the policies in place that help your communities grow and your data center cluster grow. But I think that one of the things that we've seen both in Loudoun County and here in Dublin is you need a champion. You need somebody who understands and then can go out and tell that story, because it's not a story that's easily accessible. People just don't envision what that story is at first. So you need a champion to go out and really teach the community and teach the elected officials and the government, you know, why this is so beneficial, When you do that and you have all the other pieces in place, that's how you really experience top growth.
It reminds me of kind of, I used to call this thing referee syndrome, where the referee has a good game, nobody notices, but he has a bad game and everybody notices. And it's kind of like an unappreciated thing, like data cluster. It's kind of like a thing nobody notices, but it actually powers the whole ecosystem, essentially, that with the current data-driven world we're in today. And that's probably part of one of the problems. And that's why your evangelist or your maverick going around telling everybody about it is so important, because you need to show linking the investment to a bottom line. And there's no better way to show that than showing what you've done in Loudoun County, because people listen to the show and may think, oh, well, that's fine. It's in the States. It's a huge place. But it's not.
It's not.
And that's where in Ireland we may have a huge opportunity. It's a very similar ecosystem. Mm-hmm. We can build an ecosystem. We have a lot of the ingredients for that mixing bowl already, right. And it's a case of pulling them together.
Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely right. And you know, one of the things that we have seen is by being able to tell that story, people really start to appreciate. And when you start talking about people's money, that's obviously a place where they'll always be interested, you know. So their tax bills, our residents' tax bills, would be significantly higher, like an additional 5 cents on the dollar without our data center cluster contributing what they contribute. And so that's a very significant way to tell that story.
Yeah, and what's interesting as well is what you said. It's schools, it's coffee shops. There's a huge growth of coffee shops here in Ireland. And I don't know if anybody's tying that down to the fact that there's a huge influx of staff from overseas, a huge growth in the job market here, disposable income.
Right.
People need coffee. And, well, we've created that need for coffee.
Sure.
But because of all these new companies, all these other businesses, these surrounding businesses have cropped up as a result. I'm sure you've seen that in Loudoun County as well.
Sure. We call it the primary, the secondary, and the tertiary effect. You know, the primary effect is the actual data centers and the money that they spend, the investment and the jobs. And then there's the secondary market. And that's all the people that service the heating and air conditioning systems, to the electricians, to the construction, to the people that clean and do security. And then there's the tertiary. It's all the people that are around that ecosystem and the money they spend at pubs like this, at the coffee shops, and when they're buying groceries and buying clothes and going out at night. All of that is really, you know, it's hard to calculate the overall impact that can give. You know, people stay in hotel rooms. People go out to eat. People come to visit. You get this influx of people that are coming in to, you know, work on the buildings or be the customers inside the buildings. It all plays together, and it's something that you have to start with the base and then just build from there.
And I'd love to tie it back actually all around using the data to actually show what the data is, actually the whole ecosystem that's building around it. Another question for you. So you're here in Ireland, in Dublin. You're about to travel over to London now. So what's the purpose of your trip?
Well, our biggest thing is that we're trying to build an economy, and we're trying to build a worldwide economy and a diverse economy. So our mission is to go out and talk to companies that might have an interest in coming to work and build a company in Loudoun County. So as we go out and we start telling that Loudoun story internationally, we have the opportunity to work with companies that might be able to take advantage of, you know, I have a place here in Dublin that leverages the data center cluster. There's a whole big market in the United States. Perhaps that would be a good place for me to work as well. So the goal is to just inform people about our county and doing business in our county and how we've built something that they could take advantage of. And we're doing that here in Dublin. And later in this week, we'll be in London doing much the same thing, talking to technology companies, talking to people that would be able to utilize a location like ours that's right outside Washington, D.C., that's home to an international airport and home to the location where 70% of the world's internet traffic passes through every single day.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously we think we have a very powerful story to tell, and we just enjoy getting out and telling that story.
Yeah, and it's something that you touched on there, was having the people near the data centers, because there's this kind of, I suppose, not a myth, but maybe a misnomer, misconception, that you can store everything anywhere. but actually having the people close to the data center clusters has a positive effect. Am I right in saying that?
It does, and that's why you're starting to see, you know, a more distributed data center mix around the world, because there is a latency to information that can be critical, especially if you're dealing with financial items or those kinds of things. You know, it used to be that if you sent somebody an email or send them a letter, you know, it would be days before they get back. In today's world, everybody thinks that as soon as they load their web page, it should be up right away. When they're streaming video, they don't want to see buffering. They want people to respond to them real time and live time. It's the way that information is being utilized now. And having that, first of all, having that close to the customer base is really important. But it's also close for data scientists and the people that are utilizing that data to be close to their information as well, because things happen instantaneously. And you think about when you're trading stocks or you're, you know, swiping your credit card, that information has to be up all the time and it has to be instantaneous.
Yeah.
And that's what we're really starting to see.
Yeah. And to bring it all right back to where you came from. So if you think about radio streaming, for example, the buffering, so that little delay, people have zero tolerance for that delay. Now, I saw a stat where Amazon said every point of a second that is delay on their website actually has an effect on revenue on the day. It's less people buying. And when you see those kind of correlations using the data that you can enable, that's when the magic happens.
And I'm as guilty as anyone. If I'm trying to watch a streaming video or listening to streaming music, if it starts buffering, I go on to listen to something else. And so then that affects the advertising, it affects the usage and everything else. So, it's becoming more and more important.
Yeah, well, Buddy Reuser, Executive Director of Loudoun County Data Center Cluster, thanks for joining us.
Really appreciate it, Aidan. Thanks to talk with you.
Cheers. So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Julia Barbara, Communications Director with Wikimedia Foundation. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
I reached out because I felt, I suppose, a lot of people in the world now at this stage take Wikipedia and Wikimedia for granted because it's been with us for such a long time. And we probably all forget that there's a machine behind the open source product. It's probably a story that hasn't been told recently enough for people to know. It'd be great to understand, Juliet, where Wikipedia and Wikimedia came from and where we are today.
Sure. Well, thank you for your interest in this. There definitely is a big machine behind Wikipedia. And you're right, not a lot of people know about it or they've heard about it and they don't remember, because Wikipedia has become something that is just a part of our daily lives. It's part of the fabric of the internet. So Wikipedia started in 2001. It was started by Jimmy Wales. And it was kind of in the early days of the internet, or mid days of the internet, you could say. And it actually started as a feeder project for another company that Jimmy Wales was working on called Newpedia. Newpedia was based on the peer-reviewed scholarly articles model, and it had a multi-step review process whereby individuals could submit an article and then experts would review it, much like they would in an academic setting. And in the first year of Newpedia, not very many articles were created. So I think about 12 articles were created in the first year. And Jimmy started working on Wiki software, which is the software that all of Wikipedia is based on. It was created by a man named Ward Cunningham. And it enabled online collaboration so that anyone could edit and contribute content. So he started with Wikipedia on Wiki. And as opposed to Newpedia, Wikipedia took off. And in its first year, about 20,000 articles were created. So he looked at this situation and his collaborators at the time did, and they realized, wow, we've really got something.
It's often what we see from a lot of innovators is they start off with one product and then pivot into one or many others. What I found just really interesting about the story is that the openness of the web then, it was seen as an enablement or an enabler rather than a taker. So people weren't there to kind of, well, there was obviously companies there to claim the new oil, but there was a lot of people like Jimmy that went, okay, well, this is an amazing opportunity to enable the world.
That's right. And there are many similarities between open source culture and what we could call open content or open knowledge culture. And, you know, I think the early days of Wikipedia did look at the web as this open commons where anyone should be able to freely access information and anyone should be able to build upon that information. It was really a time of abundance, and Wikipedia reflects that today.
How many kind of people do you have behind the machine?
Well, there are roughly 80,000 volunteers who make more than 5 edits per month.
So there are people like you or me, or well, me, people who aren't actually in the company, in Wikimedia Foundation. These are actual people around the world who just have a genuine interest.
That's right. They are volunteers. You know, by and large, the vast majority don't get paid. This is something that they do for many reasons. Some do it because they're just so passionate about a particular topic or about the culture of collaboration and contribution. It really is a form of volunteerism and free contribution.
Yeah, and across the world, so like we see this with stuff like Flickr, I suppose, as well, Juliet, where, you know, people basically upload and tag and metadata, etc. But one of the phenomenal things, I suppose, about Wikipedia and Wikimedia is that people correct other people's and make it, it's all about making it simpler to be comprehended, simple comprehension. And a lot of people don't know that they have the right to come in and go, actually, that's not correct. I actually know a little bit about this. And, you know, for example, somebody played 51 times for the Yankees, not 50 times. And here's the source that I saw that from.
That's right. It turns out a magical thing happens when you keep something like this open. People come to the table and they improve it. There's a concept in software development: with enough eyes, all bugs are shallow. Well, we see the same thing take place on Wikipedia. The more people who are contributing to an article, generally, the better it gets, because you have more people who are going to catch inaccuracies, issues that are not, you know, maybe neutral or are biased, and can actually expand the content.
Yeah.
And so every day you have people, 7,000 new articles are created every day, 15,000 edits a minute. I mean, this is happening constantly behind the scenes on Wikipedia. It's always improving and changing.
One of the things I always find fascinating about Wikipedia is it's like SEO gold. So, I mean, from a search engine perspective, it's always the first thing up there, and it's promoted to the top of a Google search rank. So for companies not to use it, or people not to use it, or individuals, or whatever your product may be, or your thought leadership, it's pretty crazy not to have a Wikipedia entry.
Yeah, well, that raises a good issue, which is that Wikipedia represents what reliable sources in the world document. And so it's not a business directory, it's not a promotional site, it's really just a reflection of what has been documented and again, reliable sources. So a lot of organizations will say, oh yes, I need a Wikipedia page, but that's not really how it works. So to have, you know, a Wikipedia article, volunteers have created a set of guidelines to assess what they call notability. So a topic needs to be notable in order to have, to be documented on Wikipedia.
Okay.
And they look at things like press coverage. They look at things like, has your organization been mentioned in a scholarly article or a research paper, or again, in the media? And so there are a variety of ways that content is assessed to get on the site.
Yeah, so that's interesting, because it's not a commercial. It doesn't have a commercial end. It's more of a social entrepreneurship program, essentially, or a foundation that's just making information more accessible. And Julia, how does it work from an international perspective? If I uploaded an article here in Ireland and we speak Irish English, how does that get translated then across the world?
Well, there are nearly 300 language Wikipedias, specific language Wikipedias out there. And it gets even as granular as simple English versus English. So there are many different ways to reflect local dialect and cultures. And each of those language Wikipedias have been built from the ground up by individual communities, which is really incredible. A lot of people think that Wikipedia just gets copied and translated into another language, but it doesn't. It is actually written by people for those projects and for those languages.
Yeah.
You know, if there's an issue of how do you say this, do you use this you know, British spelling versus American spelling, those are issues that are usually handled on what's called a talk page. Every article has a talk page behind it, which is a discussion page where editors can discuss how things are going to be portrayed on the article, you know, whether things are cited carefully. So that usually gets worked out through conversation.
So essentially, if I write an article here, it's picked up from scratch in a different country, in India or France or Germany. They'll write it from scratch. It's not a program that picks it up and translates it.
That's right. We do have some tools that assist editors if they want to reflect, if they want to copy content and put it over to another, in another language on another project. But really, you know, knowledge reflects so many different aspects of culture and language. And one country's or one language's knowledge might be different than another language's or culture's.
So from a country per country perspective, is there a way people can get involved, Juliet, in their own country? You mentioned the translations, etc. Is there active communities in every country?
Yeah, virtually every country. A lot of times volunteers will organize through what are called chapters or affiliate organizations. So today there are 41 chapters around the world, including one in Ireland, actually, the Wikimedia Ireland, user group. And they are active in your country, and they're supporting the local community, doing really great projects like Wiki Loves Monuments, where they encourage people to take pictures of monuments in Ireland and post them online to make them freely available for everyone to enjoy.
At the moment, how many employees are behind the machine?
Well, it kind of depends what you mean by machine. So the volunteer community...
The organization, sort of, yeah.
The organization,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's as part of the Wikimedia Foundation, we're about 300 people, mostly in San Francisco, California, where we are headquartered. And the Wikimedia Foundation is interesting because we're not the ones that write Wikipedia. In fact, it's very important for us that we make sure the community has independence over the content on Wikipedia. They're the ones that decide what stays and what goes, and they do the contributing. Our role is to support the projects, the community, and the movement. So we run the data servers, we run the technology behind Wikipedia, we create new technology like native mobile apps, and we support the community through monetary and non-monetary resources and do all of the other core functions that come along with, you know, a nonprofit supporting a major global website. Like Wikipedia, our funding model is, in a sense, crowdsourced. You know, a lot of nonprofits will have major foundation donations supporting the bulk of their work. For us, we have, I think, 70% of our funding comes from small reader donations and really small. You know, the average donation is $15, but every single one matters because this is what allows us to, you know, maintain independence and make sure that we're still supporting the projects at that scale.
Yeah, and I mean, that's how we originally reached out, was because I, as I said, I use imagery for my blog, and it came up that making a donation, and I went, you know what, I need to spread this word, because it is something that we all take for granted, the fantastic work that you do.
Well, thank you very much. It's definitely all credit due to the volunteers.
Yeah. And people can donate by just going to a Wikipedia page, and they'll get a place to donate. Is that always on?
It's not always on. So we do tests throughout the year, which is why you might see them at different times. But generally, we try to keep the donation, the active funding campaigns, to a specific time of year. So a couple weeks. You know, our big English campaign, where we reach out to all of our English readers, is in December. But you can donate at any time by going to the Wikimedia Foundation website.
Juliet, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for taking the time. Juliet Barbara, Director of Communications with Wikimedia Foundation, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Aidan.